Welcome to the Spooktator Film Podcast. I'm Austin.
And I'm Max.
And today we are playing The Most Dangerous Game, in which listeners will find us in the woods and shoot us with an elephant rifle.
Well-deserved, honestly. I get it.
After over 100 episodes of this.
If you've listened to over 100 episodes of this show, you definitely deserve to be able to hunt us in the woods.
Yes. But if you, in case you couldn't tell already, the movie we're doing is the 1932 classic, The Most Dangerous Game. And it's my pick, and it's a movie I've been a fan of for a long time. And Max, before I go into my history with this movie, I just wanted to get a little bit of the temperature on this movie. You like this movie, right?
Yeah, I hadn't seen it in quite a while, and it was very different than I remembered, but I do thoroughly enjoy it.
Yeah.
I think it's perfect length, perfect premise, incredibly well done, some great underlying themes there, expands upon the incredibly short story it's based off of, and I don't really have negative things to say about this.
Yeah, sometimes it is hard to sum up a movie like this when it just delivers such a satisfying experience in such a like succinct package. But nevertheless, that's what we're going to try to do in the commentary track. But so I can't remember the first time I saw this movie, but it's definitely something where I really enjoyed it at the time, and my appreciation has grown with time. At first, it was a movie I kind of enjoyed just for the experience of watching it, but I've come around on it and really thought about like different areas in which there's a lot of subtext to this movie, and also just the significance of being the origin point of this premise of like the manhunt genre, which has given us stuff as diverse as like Predator or Battle Royale, or even like that movie last year from Damon Lindelof, which I don't remember the name of.
I was going to say, if you like Predator or Battle Royale, we have done both of those on the show before, so go back and listen to those episodes.
Yeah, this is not the first manhunt movie we've done, but obviously it's had a really big impact. I don't know. I just think it's kind of fun. And it is worth mentioning how nice it is to watch a movie that's 63 minutes long and how like that length feels very appropriate for it.
I was going to say, just really briefly, we're in the middle of Twitter discourse where people saying like, listen, Venom 2 is only 90 minutes long. Does that mean it's going to be a bad movie? And just real quick, I want to say, if you equate movie length with potential quality, you need to stop analyzing films. I understand Lord of the Rings and stuff were like 8 hours long, but just because a movie is long doesn't mean it has a lot to say or it's going to use its time well.
Yeah, and just to clarify, like people saying that it might be bad because it's short.
Yes.
With Venom 2, which
is
just like...
It's only 90 minutes.
Oh, God forbid it's a tight 90. Jesus Christ. It's just ridiculous. I think part of that too is like, it's a relief to watch stuff like this now because we're in this era where it's saturated by like content brain. Everything is equated to how much shit you can pack into it, you know? And it makes for movies that are really unsatisfying. So I think the length really adds a very, like, satisfying element to this movie.
I agree. I personally think this movie could go on for, like, even 10, 15 more minutes and still be just as tight. But the fact that they got everything they wanted to in such a short amount of time.
And there's a ton of shit to talk about in this movie, too.
So much.
Yeah. Like, we're not going to be able to cover it at all because this is really a very important movie historically, and it's had a really big artistic influence. So I'm just very excited to talk about this movie.
Yep, same. I don't want to give away any of our other points for this, so I say I'm going to give you, Austin, about a 2-hour head start, and let's go into the woods and play The Most Dangerous Game. And just to clarify for our listeners, we are watching the fantastic Criterion version of this film.
Yes.
I mean, not that it matters too much. It's only 60 minutes. It might be slightly out of sync with what we're seeing if you're watching a different version.
Sure. This movie, I think, is in the public domain. I might be wrong
about
that.
Yes, no, it did.
It is?
The Most Dangerous Game went into the public domain, I believe, 2020, actually.
Oh, wow.
So it very recently went into the public domain.
Okay. So, yeah, this movie is in the public domain, so I think you can find a bunch of versions of it online. Either way, I think it starts off very solid with this interesting opening credit sequence where we see this image of the centaur that's going to recur throughout the rest of the movie and I think really hits on a lot of the movie's kind of like post-colonial themes about... I don't know, the ideas of like defining lesser humans, with the centaur being this figure that's kind of like between humans and monsters, you know, it's kind of embodying the ambiguity of both at the same time.
It's interesting because I took it very straightforwardly as the villain of this film is a master of hunting animals. He's bored with how many animals he's killed, so he started hunting humans, and that makes him the real beast at the end of it. It's a very straightforward interpretation, but I don't think it's entirely off base.
Yeah.
But you were talking about that there are different layers to that, and the viewing different humans as animals is a very interesting, especially since him and all of his lackeys are Cossacks, historically discriminated against group in Russia, which is an interesting aspect. I don't know.
Yes, the Russian side of this is very interesting for reasons we'll get into for sure. But I also think what you're talking about too, our two readings of this are not mutually exclusive
at all.
Yeah. And the fact of like the centaur constantly holding on to like this woman, I think it is interesting because I think it speaks to the implications of how the Zaroff character is going to treat Fay Wray as this kind of like sexual prize that he will then dominate and pursue after he's killed something and regained after he solved his impotence. Because apparently we're going to get hints throughout this movie that this character cannot get hard or have any sort of sexual gratification unless they've killed something, which is obviously very frightening. To me, I don't know if it scares you, Max.
No, I'm fine. I'll be okay. So I do just want to quickly bring up my slight misremembering of this movie.
Okay.
In my mind, this story was about a rich person hunting poor people who are on his island for sport. That's not really it. There is a different type of struggle going on here, but this is a luxury yacht, and all of the people we see on this yacht are incredibly wealthy, well off. We see a couple of the crew members very briefly when the ship crashes, but their lives are not taken into account at all, really. So it's more the rich hunting the rich, and the thing that's supposed to scare you more is the idea that any human would hunt people for sport just for thrills. And I like that. It's not the story I would tell, but I enjoy the fact that this story exists.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, I can understand why you might confuse it with other versions of this story, because there's been really so many different movies that utilize this framework of the rich, and specifically like the ultra rich hunting people, whether it's like lesser rich people or actually poor people. But it is always something that's like practiced by the wealthy exclusively. So I understand why it would be easy to confuse that if you hadn't seen this movie, you know, recently. And also this movie has been remade several times, throughout classic Hollywood. So it makes complete sense why you might even have seen a different version and seen like a difference in how it was adapted then. But you're definitely right when you say like the way it situates Joel McRae as the victim here is like very peculiar and interesting, because he's kind of like an adventurer. He's like the platonic idea of an adventurer, kind of very similar to Marion C. Cooper himself. And we talked about in our King Kong episode about how like Marion C. Cooper kind of like self-inserted a lot of his ideologies into the Carl Denham character in some ways. And I feel like there's maybe a similar thing going on here, even though Marion C. Cooper was a little bit less involved with the production of this movie than he was King Kong. We should also mention, before it gets confusing, that this movie and King Kong were made by the same team simultaneously. That's why you got Robert Armstrong and Fay Wray appearing in it later.
Which is remarkable, honestly. Two incredibly quality movies.
And hugely influential.
Yeah.
You know, like, they're both really important movies.
Now I'm thinking, though, like, I'm glad that Peter Jackson didn't remake this movie.
You're like, talking about ruining the length.
Yeah, like we said, this movie, one of this movie's strengths is that it is able to tell such a story in such a concise amount of time.
Yeah.
I don't need an hour and a half of the movie being this guy's backstory of him taking pictures of wildlife and...
Yeah, well, Max, there was actually, funny, now that you mention it, there was a scene in this where they roll everyone down a river in fucking barrels trying to escape, but they realized it didn't make sense.
Listen, I separate stuff like King Kong, which Peter Jackson generally wanted to make, and I do enjoy Jackson's Peter Kong, Jackson's Peter Kong, Peter Jackson's King Kong.
Peter Kong was his cousin.
His less known cousin. I do enjoy that movie, but that type of movie lends itself to it. The Hobbit movies, Jackson didn't want to direct them in the first place.
No.
They're bad. They're all bad. It doesn't matter.
And he can't make big, over-the-top, expensive movies that he doesn't actually want to make with the same, like, you know, verve and, like, power as Francis Ford Coppola. Like, yeah. Francis Ford Coppola is really good at making expensive movies that he actually doesn't want to make at all. Godfather 3 aside.
Yeah.
Anyway, I really like that moment because, you know, Joel McRae, our protagonist for this movie, is like, nothing's going to sink this ship. And then, like, almost with comedic timing, the plot of the movie is like, hey, motherfucker, what's up? And it just sinks their ship. And Max, you mentioned earlier that we're going to see certain shots of the crew later. And is where where it happens. And it is shocking. Even though I've seen this movie a bunch, I don't think it registered with me until this week that, like, what happens to the crew when this boat hits the rocks is, like, shockingly violent. For our listeners who haven't seen this, what happens is they get trapped in the lower decks, and it looks like a furnace that's powering the boat hits the water, and they die because they get blasted with steam. What the fuck? Yeah. And it actually shows them, like, writhing in pain. It is a 30s movie, so you don't see, like, their skin boiling, but, like, you know, it is really noteworthy to see a movie like this show, like, human death like that.
Yeah. Well, it's okay. A lot of these people are going to get mercifully saved by a shark later. The shark is going to drag them to safety.
Yes, of course. That's what happened. And in the meantime, another disturbing thing just happened where, like, sailors were like, oh, you're holding on to me and you're drowning me.
Yeah, that's like, that goes on for quite a while, and it's pretty disturbing, especially for a 30s movie.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I mentioned to you that, because you mentioned that this is pre-Hays Code, so they can get away with a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, about 18 months prior.
Yeah, and I just watched, or rewatched Some Like It Hot, and that is a movie that is very often referred to as the death knell of the Hays Code, because it was released without its approval and did super, super well. But it's just, stop trying to restrict what you can put in movies. It's
I mean, like, definitely the Hays Code throughout the 50s, too. Like, you're talking about the financial success of Some Like It Hot. It was clear at a certain point that, like, the Hays Code was detrimental to financial success across the board.
Yeah.
Like, a lot of B's movies throughout the 50s actually came up as, like, as something that was really challenging the Hays Code. I know you have a very apologistic love for them, but movies like them, even though it's kind of, like, reserved in a lot of what it offers, like, B movies like that, they were really pushing the boundaries of Hays Code stuff all throughout the 50s, you know? The Hays Code has always been, like, you know, I would say hugely detrimental, even though there were some unintended side effects in terms of, like, restrictions creating, you know, other interesting forms of art.
Well, yeah, like, truly creative people will always be able to make interesting art despite restrictions, but a lot of the time those restrictions aren't necessary and are detrimental to the kind of art you can create in general.
And by the way, the stuff we remember now for being really impressive and communicating that stuff in spite of the Hays Code, those are things we remember because they stick out from the crowd. You know, it's not like the norm. But Max, it's funny you mentioned the Hays Code because I can tell you for a fact that those inserts of the sharks with the gore actually coming out of their mouths, those were removed for the 1938 reissue of this movie, which obviously is 5 years post-Hays Code. So there's right there in that scene is a solid example of what the Hays Code does. And stuff like that is like, what difference does it make? I don't know. It's all arbitrary. But nonetheless, like, violations of the Hays Code, even though this was a pre-code movie, but like, violations of what would be in the Hays Code is something that really stuck out to me during rewatching it. If we were listening to the music, Max, I want to give a quick shout out to Max Steiner. If we were listening to the music, we would have heard some really interesting musical cues when he actually sees the vista of the beach and he sees that the shore lights were misaligned, and then we see that castle in the distance. The really interesting thing that kind of like would probably go over the heads of most modern viewers about Max Steiner's score is how he kind of invented the vernacular for like scores in talkies, because before that people had kind of didn't have an idea about how to use music alongside actual spoken dialogue. And scenes like that was like, okay, we use music to accentuate vistas, to communicate a sense of grandeur. You know, we can use it to really accentuate moments instead of having it playing the entire time. And that's why, like, movies like this are really actually subtly influential in terms of, like, film music history, because we take a lot of that for granted now. But he kind of invented the blueprint.
Here we have not Boris Karloff. I don't know why this isn't Boris Karloff or Bela Lugosi or somebody. Would have been great for that role.
He is very similar to the Sayer of the Law role compared to the Island of Lost Souls.
Don't bring that up again.
Why?
I do love this movie, but your direct comparison to the Island of Lost Souls kind of made me enjoy it slightly less the other day.
The Island of Lost Souls definitely has some advantages over this movie. But this actor, I think this actor is a good actor. Their name is Noble Johnson. They would do like a lot of
all of those fucking ignoble Johnsons, those fucking traitorous Johnsons.
Those are the types of jokes that are going to get us shot by our listeners.
Good.
In the woods.
It's go on our Patreon. It's the $10,000 tier.
We didn't mention that, but we did start a Patreon tier as like a promotional effort with this episode where I'm not kidding you. If you go to our Patreon, you can find a tier where you can go hunt Max in the woods. I'm not kidding.
Oh,
go to
no,
our
it's
website.
It's either of us, but Austin.
No,
Austin
it's Max.
Austin.
I already made it, Max. It's you.
I feel like that's unfair. I feel like if our listeners want to hunt one of us for sport, they should be able to choose for $10,000.
We'll talk about this after the episode. This is behind the scenes stuff. We're not going to show this to the listeners. But Noble Johnson, Max, is nonetheless still kind of a cool actor, but I think the role is probably a weak point for this movie. There's not a lot going on there.
True.
You know? But maybe that's part of the point too, you know. He never speaks, he takes commands like a dog, you know. It is very conspicuously similar to Island of Lost Souls, though, which came out the same year. I'm not saying they copied each other, but
no.
It does speak to like how this movie has certain implications for like post-colonialism.
I get that. It's just we have an incredibly charismatic, charming lead villain. Not quite as charismatic or charming as the lead villain in Island of Lost Souls.
Yes, it is quite hard to compare to Charles Laughton.
Charles Laughton is fucking hypnotizing in that movie. And we have a nearly beast person sidekick.
Who is also not Bela Lugosi.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand it. Definitely different like associations with like acting ability as well. Leslie Banks plays Count Zaroff, and I think he does an admirable job, and I think there's some interesting things about his biography that we'll bring up over the course of the commentary that really add to his performance, but he definitely is not on the same caliber as Charles Laughton. That being said, he's definitely an actor that I think got famous and sort of built his career off of playing villains. His first big hit after he sort of started becoming an actor full-time was playing a stage performance of Captain Hook, I think in 1924. So he'd already been known for, you know, his ability to portray villainy. And then this movie made him like very popular in the UK. So he would continue to play roles like that. Visually, he reminds me a lot of Walter Pidgeon, and my brain wants to like autocorrect to make him Walter Pidgeon.
Yeah, I can kind of see that, yeah.
Nobody had a goatee like Walter Pidgeon.
Is it just the goatee, or is it... I don't know. No, but we're like 10, 15 minutes into the movie, and like boats already sank. Guy's already found the main villain. He's already inside the house. Like, we just keep moving. Like, I feel we can't get into our normal trappings of the show of just like going off on stupid irrelevant rants because we'll have missed the movie by the time we're done.
Yeah, and we're about to reach one of the most interesting sections of the movie where this is where it starts to change visually. I think the first hint of this is when you actually get the close-up of him using the knocker to actually enter the door, where it really highlights how like the knocker is kind of like, in retrospect, you realize that it's kind of like this gross thing where even without realizing it, in order to enter this man's domain, you have to like interact with his bizarre fetish object, right?
Yeah.
And we're going to get more and more of that throughout the rest of this movie. And it starts with close-ups like that of Fay Wray, the introduction of Fay Wray, where it seems like it's highlighting her, not only because she's like one of the principal actors and she's like the female lead, but this movie doesn't have a romance, right? And in retrospect, seeing close-ups like that speaks to the fact that Fay Wray is kind of in this movie giving a layered performance. I think her performance is probably the best in the movie, honestly, because she has to play a certain tension where she's maintaining a sense of normalcy, even while she's harboring the suspicion that something is terribly wrong.
I think this moment of her performance, at this scene, rather, I would agree with you. I think the movie kind of shoves her in a corner later on, but
yeah, she, after this moment, she definitely does not fulfill that same sort of dramatic function, because with the second half of the movie, it is mostly, Joel McRae versus Leslie Banks. And the fact that Fay Wray is there is kind of like, I don't know.
Incidental, almost.
Yeah, I mean, she's kind of there. It is weird that he's setting her loose with him. Because he says himself that he says later very grossly that he's not going to shoot a female animal.
Yeah.
And we get heavy implications that like Leslie Banks probably wants to fuck Fay Wray after he kills something. So it doesn't really make sense for him to put her in the jungle, but I don't like visually to have a man and woman running together. It kind of makes sense. I can tell you that Fay Wray being in this movie and the addition of a woman to it, which was not in the source material, is something that the financiers were kind of looking for. All things considered, I think it works pretty well.
Oh my God, he called him a flagpole sitter.
Which we had to look up was a very weird thing that...
I thought it would be like... that weird 50s term for insinuating somebody was gay, the confirmed bachelor, but apparently it's...
No, it is literal.
Yeah.
There is a literal thing with flagpole sitting. It was kind of fascinating to learn about. I guess people just did it to get attention.
I think the term, I looked it up after you brought it up. The term means like an attention grabber, somebody who will do anything to get attention.
But also there were professional flagpole sitters.
There were people who sat on flagpoles, but... I believe the term in this context is
like
supposed
influencers.
To be... Yeah, it's supposed to be like somebody who will do anything to get like famous or attention. So it's sort of a fun jab at this character at this point.
Yeah. What do you think of Robert Armstrong's performance here?
He's definitely drunk.
See, that's an interesting part of this because this movie came out right at the tail end of Prohibition. But also, I got the impression from my research that Marion C. Cooper was a little bit of a... I got the impression that he looked down on drunk people, or he looked down on people who consume alcohol in general. Like, he was someone who looked at Prohibition and thought it was like a morally upright good thing. So that complicates what I think about this, because a lot of the subtext of this movie, I think it's very easy to look into it and think of it as like, okay, we're here with this Joel McRae character, but then throughout the movie, he's going to have his bourgeois morality, you know, subverted. And the alcohol is like an example of like a host providing for their guests, right? But then in reality, it's like, you know, the twist and the subversion on that is like, oh, the host is evil and they're using alcohol to dull the senses and make... the guests vulnerable before they consume them.
Yeah, well, we see that very early on. We're like, literally one of the first things he does to this guy is like, oh yeah, I have some clothes for you. You have a room. Also, here, have a stiff drink.
Yeah.
And he keeps trying to get this guy to drink. He keeps trying to...
Yeah, and they motivate it plot-wise where it's like, okay, Count Zaroff doesn't want to hunt them while they're drunk, but making them drunk makes them a little bit socially pliable. And as we can see, Count Zaroff is maybe not the most socially graceful person. So any assistant he can get to like help keep up the charade that things are normal, he'll probably take. Either way, that wrinkle about Marion C. Cooper is kind of interesting. Other biographical things that are interesting. Leslie Banks, he actually, the left side of his face, as we'll see here in this specific shot, it was paralyzed from a war injury in World War I.
Fuck, man. Like, yeah, no, he still, like, is a fantastic actor despite that, but...
I don't think you would notice it unless you brought it up, but now that you look at it with that in mind, it is actually quite noticeable.
In the very extreme close-ups, like we just had, you can tell, but other than that, it just kind of, like, he overacts with the rest of his face to compensate for it, and it works very well, I would say.
Yeah, it is kind of interesting how he gets around it. It did not stop him from becoming a successful actor at all. So there you go. Pretty interesting in terms of how his career developed in reference to that. But either way, if you look up other stills of him from like different movies, it seems like comparatively this movie really leaned into using that side of his face a lot more.
I did express sympathy for him and his henchmen earlier because they were Cossacks, a historically persecuted group in Russia. But also we just learned that he's bourgeoisie scum who escaped the Russian Revolution with the majority of his fortune.
Well, I mean, and I didn't even assume that Zaroff was Cossack.
Oh, no, he is.
Okay.
He early on, he's like, oh, we Cossacks have a way of getting around things.
Either way, what you just brought up is one of the really interesting parts of this that makes you really wonder about like the politics of the source material. Because if you were trying to, in a very politically conscious way, like depict like an idea of like decadent aristocracy, and remember the short story was written in 1924, doing it with like an old Russian aristocrat is like a really solid way to do that.
Yeah.
Here's one of those fetishistic close-ups I mentioned. It's not a type of close-up that you would see from the time period, I feel, because it reflects something about the interiority of the Leslie Banks character. Like seeing him fondle that like lion skull, it does kind of skeeve you out. And the fact that they cut to a close-up of it to really signify its importance really accentuates that in a way that I love. And again, we're going to see that, you know, a few times. And we'll see it later where we get like a really early version of like POV where Leslie Banks is chasing them through the leaves whipping across his face.
Yeah.
I got to say, like just to give people a little peek behind the curtain, we've been drinking more than we intended to. And I kind of feel like Robert Armstrong right now.
I was going to say, so speaking of other conversations we had earlier, he's about to go hunt this guy, and he does insist that he let him sober up before he started hunting him. This guy's pretty fucking drunk right now. I think it takes longer than 2 hours to sober up after that.
You're gonna need to give him a lot of fucking coffee.
And also, I know humans are more intelligent than any other animal on Earth. I still don't think we're the most dangerous game.
Like, absolutely not. We were talking about like, hey, this fucking guy would be great to get rid of those goddamn hippos in Colombia from Pablo Escobar.
I'm on team hippo on that side of the argument. I think we should let hippos take over all of Colombia and most of South America.
I don't know about South America. U.S., sure, bring them on. Bring them to New York. Who fucking cares? It doesn't matter. They're going to love the subways. They're filled with water.
A Colombian hippo in New York sounds like a fantastic movie. But
bring the army. Bring all of them. Yeah, I mean, I don't know enough about the environment of Colombia to make a like solid statement about whether or not they're good.
No, there have been a lot of scientists coming out and being like, listen, nobody wants to do this, but
yeah,
we probably should kill all the hippos because they're going to fuck over the ecosystem immensely, because the largest predator in South America is a jaguar, and ain't no jaguar taking down a hippopotamus.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Regardless, I don't think, like, it's just funny to think, like, this guy wants to hunt humans.
Yeah.
It's like, there are more dangerous animals. By the way, here's another like pre-code moment where, again, we're getting that hint of his kind of like deviant sexuality, where he's talking about kill, then love. Very explicit comments about like, you know, the act of sex that I feel like the Hays Code was very timid about and you would never get directly. It had to be much more veiled than that. But Max, it's interesting to talk about like just the mechanics of how they set this up, because one of the most interesting things I think about this premise is how the idea of having this scary story about a guy who hunts humans is really dependent upon existence in like a post-industrialist, post-scarcity world. Like, this would not have been scary to someone like 200 years ago in the same way, you know? Like, the idea of this is specifically frightening to people because...
Look at all those dogs.
Look at all those dogs. I got some trivia about those dogs
coming
up. But Max, I think the idea of how scary this is like specifically targeted at like a post-scarcity audience. Because obviously, you know, hunting, you don't have to hunt in order to get food or resources. And the thing that's insane about this is that, you know, when you don't have to hunt to get food or resources, obviously that's going to be something that's more like a pastime of people who can afford to do it and do it for sport. And this is like the furthest removed from hunting animals for sustenance that you can get is that you've gotten to the point where you're so involved with doing this for a pastime to meet your own whims and your own appetite that you are hunting other humans. So it's the furthest it can get from that like cycle of material consumption that made hunting necessary for humans for thousands of years.
I do like this clever use of her brother's idiocy to try to be like, listen, something shitty is going on.
Yeah. And it is really good, Max, because the movie keeps the tension going on from scene to scene, despite the fact that it's not Hunt all the time, in a way that I think is actually quite delicate and well done. Like every scene is kind of a thriller scene. You know what I mean? The only moment of where there's a brief break in terms of the drama and tension is when he's being introduced to the castle setting, at which point you're so taken by these, you know, fancy sets and the nice matte paintings that you're kind of like really attracted to the novelty of it. And you're like on the movie side. And then the movie sets you in this really interesting scenario where it's like this kind of like domestic situation where they're all trying to, you know, like Faye Ray is kind of guiding the drama here, and she's trying to not, you know, key off Count Zaroff that she knows something is up, right?
Yeah.
It's just a really interesting way to play with the stakes and keep things going.
See, the place where Zaroff fucked up is he does have a boat to the mainland. I would just, if I were a psychopathic murderer who wanted to hunt people for sport, I would just be like, oh, sorry, it's a small boat. It can only fit one at a time. And the trip is like 2 weeks long or whatever. So just say that you're taking them back one at a time. And that way you can hunt them without arousing the suspicion of anybody with an IQ higher than 10.
Very dangerous of you, Max. Very sneaky. Listeners, they gotta kill you before it's too late.
Before I kill you.
Yeah, that's really the lesson here, isn't it? Also, Max, we just talked over that really big camera move where it goes all across the atrium, you know? And correct me if I'm wrong, Max, but you don't see a lot of that stuff in King Kong. You see a lot of technical wizardry in King Kong, but I feel like the really adventurous camera moves you don't see as much, which is interesting. I didn't get the impression reading up on this that, like, there's really any difference in how seriously King Kong was taken by Ernest B. Schoedsack. Compared to, or no, this movie wasn't taken less seriously or whatever. He equally wanted to make this movie and also wanted to make it just as good. Even though King Kong had a much larger budget and had a larger scope. So like, I don't think he was like saying, fuck it, I'll throw the camera around or anything. I think it is interesting though. Like, I feel like this movie has a very definitively different like visual identity than King Kong. But maybe that has to do with the limitations of how you want to show a lot of special effects, you know?
Yeah. I do love the sets, especially. I mean, the forest sets flow together wonderfully. This Portuguese fortress set really sets the tone early on. Wonderful yeah. use of it. I love it.
And, of course, I think, I don't know when this movie was being produced exactly in 1932, but I wonder what the overlap was with Dracula, just because Count Zaroff is so goddamn similar to Dracula in so many ways. I mean, they're both very obvious images of like decadent aristocracy from the old world. But also they use the same like social tricks to try to disarm people. You know, they welcome people into their house, they give them food and drink, and then they come after them in the night. So, Max, have you seen Joel McRae in any other movies?
Probably. I can't recall any off the top of my head. How about you?
I've seen him in a ton of movies, and I always find him fascinating as an actor because he's kind of like the Forrest Gump of classic Hollywood.
Oh, yeah, you were telling me this.
Yeah, he has like an amazing career. He's been in so many fantastic movies, but in so many cases, he was not the guy they originally wanted. So he's kind of just like the leftover actor who kind of like walked backwards into starring in a bunch of really amazing movies. And I don't know, I kind of just like him. I definitely think his like technical capabilities as an actor, he definitely got better with age. I think his performances later on are probably a lot more solid than this. But this movie was really the first big hit for him. He had an opportunity to sort of turn in a starring role in a movie called The Big Trail in 1930, directed by Raoul Walsh, but he lost to the one and only John Wayne. But this movie was kind of the third movie in his career that was ramping up to stardom, and this was one that really helped him.
Oh, God, yeah. No, he was in a lot of fucking westerns.
Yes. The most recent of which that I watched was The Stars in My Crown, which has another horror connection because it was directed by Jacques Tourneur.
Oh, God, he was also in the movie called The Oklahoma Man. I hate that.
Unless it's a porno. Which it has got to be.
Well, that's... Fun fact, did you know for Hannah Montana, her original name was supposed to be Alexis Texas, until they found out that was already the pre-existing name of a porn star. So Disney had to change their plans.
That is such a weird name for a porn star.
Alexis Texas?
I guess it makes sense because it rhymes, but like, yeah. Why? Like, Texas? What?
Some southern charm porn.
I guess. Was that her? Are you familiar with the work of Alexis Texas?
I can't say.
No. Oh, Max, we just talked over the first gore thing. This mounted head on the wall.
Yeah. I do. Like I said earlier, 10 or 15 minutes more, I could have appreciated in this movie. Like, I could have used more hunting things, and I really wouldn't mind more just like spectacle of the trophy room.
Max, I got really disappointing news for you. They shot it, and it was in the original cut of the movie, which was actually 73 minutes long, I think.
Really?
And it upset audiences too much. I can tell you that in the original cut, I don't know if that footage still exists, but in the original cut with the trophy room footage, they had a few other set pieces they were going to. One was like a taxidermied soldier fighting off dogs, but they were like ripping into his flesh. And then the other one was like a really disgusting, emaciated corpse, apparently, of someone who is in the process of being like skinned or something. So there were additional elements of this. I could also tell you that Ernest B. Schoedsack and Marion C. Cooper apparently put a lot of work into trying to learn how to pickle human heads in order to make it look like appropriate with the heads in the jars. Which we only see one in this movie, unfortunately.
Very briefly, yeah.
But maybe they were planning on having a whole, like, you know, library of human heads in jars. That's also a situation where you could have, like, really worked in a very disturbing, like, post-colonial element to this. You have him talk about, like, the skulls of the people he's killed and their attributes. Shit like that is always, like, very disturbing. As it is, we're going to get a you know, basic version of that here. This is the moment where Count Zaroff is going to explain his whole villainous scheme and philosophy to Rainsford, who he assumes is, like him, like a quote-unquote enlightened individual. You're a hunter like me, Rainsford.
Yeah.
This is also part of the movie where I really appreciate Count Zaroff's legacy as kind of like a supervillain character. It doesn't really scream supervillain at first, right? Because the premise is so specific. But when you really think about it, it's like, oh man, this is setting up tropes that would be used by like so many James Bond movies. Any movie where there's like a villainous person with a lair. A lot of it like can be read to like refer back to this imagery that they're using. I just think it works really well. Another side of that too, Max, to go back to a preparation conversation we had during the prep screening, is how Count Zaroff is kind of also like an archetype for like serial killers and like serial killer movies. You might not really think of this movie as a serial killer movie right away, because I think it is so focused on the premise that you kind of overlook the fact that it's about a serial killer. But he is, right?
Yeah, and it's weird because you almost like, oh, well, he's not a serial killer because you kind of buy into his own premise. No, he's hunting people. And then like it takes, at least for me, it like takes a second for your brain to be like, no, he's just killed a bunch of people. And
well, yeah.
And gained their body parts.
It is. I mean, obviously, this movie has a strong legacy with serial killers. I think probably the biggest the biggest like IMDb trivia thing about this movie is probably going to be that the Zodiac killer mentioned, like, name dropped this movie or whatever to try to be like fucking edgy or something.
Can't believe Ted Cruz would do that. I don't know how he keeps winning elections.
And then also there was a serial killer in Alaska that did something vaguely similar to this, although obviously, you know, if you want to make this more true to life, you would do what the serial killer in Alaska did, where they were hunting like sex workers, people that like the police don't really care about, wouldn't bother investigating. But then there were signs that he would like let them loose in the woods and like hunt them. In obviously very disturbing ways. But I think the thing that really solidifies this movie as a serial killer movie, we can talk about what that means for something to be a serial killer movie, is that it really focuses on his like pathology. You know, it's not just the premise that this movie really explores. It's the fact that like, oh, there's this disturbed mind that is driving it and organizing this premise. So this movie is really about like that pathology and makes really concentrated attempts to link his violence with sexuality, which I think is definitely a big part of how like serial killers are portrayed in movies throughout the rest of film history. There's always a mixture of violence with sex. That's probably one of the most defining things of how they're portrayed. For better or for worse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's equally possible to... I know both of us like The Silence of the Lambs, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a fantastic movie.
But that is the perfect example of like the ambiguity of portrayal of serial killers in relationship to gender and sexuality, right?
I was watching a very interesting piece on that recently, but how characters like Buffalo Bill set back the public's image of transgender people decades. Even though, like, if you watch Silence of the Lambs, like, there's a very specific scene in that movie where Clarice is just like, there's no link between transgenderism and violence. They're very passive. They just want to be happy. Yeah. Nobody fucking remembers that line of the movie. Just,
yeah.
Everybody does remember, would you fuck me? I'd fuck me.
I'd fuck me
so hard. People remember the creepy shit. They don't remember the disclaimers of actually real transgender people aren't like this.
Yes. Unfortunately, in order to communicate that to people, you'd have to derail the movie to have like a trans character come in and be like, no, I'm the good one.
I'm a transgender FBI agent and I'm going to help you catch Shannon.
That is the only way you could communicate to people that not all trans people are like that. And then, you know, real trans people will be like, oh, fuck, an FBI agent?
Yeah.
That's fucking lame. So now it's an unwinnable situation.
Exactly.
But nonetheless, Max, I think all of it refers back to, you know, the portrayal of this character. And it's like, yep,
yes.
It has all of this in this, you know, the connection of sexuality with violence and the viewing of it as kind of like deviant. I will say though, like, I really appreciate the way he like vocally portrays that. I think there's a lot of great lines that were added to the script that were not in the story. Stuff like where he talks about hunting being the whip of all other passions. Lines like that are just so well written and evocative. It's like, damn, like, did a really good job with that.
Oh, no, and even,
screenwriter,
like...
Creelman is the guy's name.
And even early on, just, like, tiny things where he goes, all pleasure is mine.
Yes, and he passes it off as a saying, and the translation is, you know, rough because of that. But then when you think about the literal... If you read the saying literally, right, it's like, oh, man, it's like he owns you. He owns everything about you.
Yes.
Because you're not
Those
a human being.
Those are long fucking cigarettes. Jesus.
Yes.
They're fucking bigger than his hand. I don't know where they sell them. I'm assuming once you become a millionaire, they just give you one. But I want one of those long cigarette holders where you can just puff on it. And so I can act like an elegant lady from the 20s.
I gotta be honest, Max, that seems kind of tacky. I think you should invent a new cigarette holder. Make your own style. Set a trend.
No, the fact that it's tacky is why I want it.
Okay.
Yeah. But you're right.
I'm beginning to understand.
I should set myself higher. I should set higher goals for myself.
I think you should like...
I should invent my own cringy, tacky thing that I do rather than just steal other stuff that rich people do.
Yes. Because then you can sell it to other people and then they convince them that you're a genius.
Exactly.
This is the path of all billionaires.
I just assume once you become a millionaire, if you're a guy, you get a monocle. And if you're a girl, you get a fancy cigarette holder. And that's your entrance to the club where... You hunt people for sport and fuck each other constantly.
Not anymore, Max. Nowadays you get...
it's ceremonial now. Nobody uses it anymore.
You get an entry card to Jeffrey Epstein's house. You it's get a still membership.
There, even if he's dead.
On a little St. James. Yeah. That's where this takes place. I don't know if you knew that.
It's on Epstein's Island.
Yes.
Imagine Epstein's Island. It's just like this horrifying fucking centaur fortress in the middle of the... Oh
it's
God.
Exactly as bad as you think it is. I mean, he does have that weird-ass building.
I haven't seen any pictures or anything of it.
But there's a weird-ass temple-looking building on his island.
That's where they extract the adrenochrome to pray to Satan, obviously.
Yes. Oh, man. I mean, this obviously does, in light of, like, Jeffrey Epstein. If he, like, that does add a disturbing dimension to this, because it's like, this shit is kind of real. Like, people get trafficked onto his fucking island. You telling me people didn't die on his island, Max? Definitely some people have died on that island.
Yeah. I honestly made a passive joke at, like, the QAnon thing recently. I hate that because, like a lot of stupid conspiracy theories, it takes away credence from the actual, like, no, the rich are actually doing horrendous shit.
We talk about this all the time, about the difference between conservative conspiracy people and then, like, left.
Just real things.
Yeah, real conspiracy nuts. Or it's like, no, you idiots. You have to adjust what you think is happening. Like, we don't live in a sci-fi world where we're, like, extracting lemonade from children.
Yeah.
We live in a world where we're just taking money from things. And the sad fact of it is, like, poor people are just sex toys for the rich. Which ultimately is also the element of this movie, where they link the hunting with sexuality. It's like, this is all like a sexual, like, practice for him. They've become indistinguishable. Oh man, I love these scenes, Max. I just love these scenes and how well they use the different layers of depth throughout their jungle set to try to show Fay Wray and
it's interesting.
Joel McRae being hunted.
Because we did King Tong not too long ago.
His other cousin.
Yeah.
King Tong. Peter Kong and King Tong.
You know what I mean.
I want to get a t-shirt of Peter Kong. That sounds great.
But King Kong, we did it. And I love the sets in that movie, but they don't really flow together. And I'm assuming because it's a much bigger scale. Like, this is a gigantic island of dinosaurs.
A lot of things have to interact with the set, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, it doesn't... It feels like, okay, we're in this part of Skull Island. Now we're in this. This, like, it does feel like the island flows together very well, and I appreciate that.
And I think they do a really good job of communicating scale. Obviously, they had these really elaborate sets that they used. This is all reused from King Kong. But, like, I think it's really interesting because they do this thing where they show, you know, their principal actors at the top of the frame, and they'll have a lot of, like, vegetation and ground beneath them. And it's this interesting thing where it's like, wow, that really sells that they're, like, in this big area compared to where if you just kept them at the bottom of the frame and shot it normally, it would look kind of like a set. They really do a good job of capturing the feel of a jungle and more specifically, like, the feel of them moving through this space, which is important because, like, the way it situates the violence is actually very interesting here, you know? Their situation and their relationship to the environment is, like, incredibly important to how they're going to be able to fight one another. The movie does a really good job of communicating that. I also really enjoy lines like this from Leslie Banks. Where
yes,
like,
I was just going to bring that up.
If you choose to play the leopard, I shall hunt you like a leopard. It creates the situation where it's almost like they're role-playing different animals to try to interact with each other. And I don't know. I think stuff like this, I don't know if this is in the original story, but I feel like this is potentially areas where, like, Marion C. Cooper's background as kind of like a vague explorer would maybe offer an advantage, because definitely he probably went hunting some rhinos at some point or tigers.
And bears?
And bears, yeah.
Oh, my.
I also think just generally the setup of the hunt and then hiding from Count Zaroff, I think it's like a very good way to circumvent the like awkward stage combat of the 1930s, even though we kind of get that a little bit later. But even then, it's more interesting than what you would normally get.
Yes. We kind of got that later. Also, his knife is made of peanut butter for whenever he
plays dogs. We'll point that out. I really thought those were more dangerous dogs than they were, but it turns out they're just Great Danes.
Yeah, they're painted Great Danes.
Yes, they were painted a different color, and they borrowed them from Harold Lloyd, of all people, which is just incredibly fucking random. Harold Lloyd, I got pictures of him. I'll show you after the episode, Max, of him at the beach with his dogs wearing like a swimming cap.
Aww.
But you got pictures of him hanging out with the dogs in this movie. Harold Lloyd seems like a fucking delight. I love that guy.
Great Danes are a delight. I love dogs that are fucking gigantic and don't realize they're fucking gigantic, so they'll just jump over you and knock you over.
I guess Great Danes are a really good choice for like a giant dog.
Yeah.
That might seem threatening if you can cut away from them wagging their tails.
Yes.
Because they will very eagerly pursue something.
Well, that's, I promise this is the last time I bring up that movie, but that's one of my favorite parts of Attack of the Killer Shrews.
Yes.
Is the fact that the killer shrews, which are just dogs in bad costumes, you can see their tails wagging at any scene where they're swarming something. And I'm just like, oh, at least the dogs are having a good time.
It is very hard to shoot stuff with a dog specifically. Because think about it, Max. How many times does a dog show up in a movie when it's like not supposed to be threatening? At least in horror movies? It's often supposed to be reacting to a monster where it's like, I don't like you. Or it's supposed to be the monster itself.
Yeah.
It's a very hard situation. Where you have that weird moment with the mechanical birds.
Or it's Air Bud.
I don't know why they felt the need to do the mechanical birds. Can't you just like shoot a gun and get like some birds to leave a tree?
Or
Very weird to me.
They used stock footage for that shark. Like,
that was actually footage from the previous movie Joel McRae was in.
Really?
Yeah.
It felt like stock footage, but...
I mean, probably just the technical limitations of shooting underwater. Either way, I feel like you could get some shots of
birds.
What
I'm saying is, like, there are shots of birds you can use, yeah. Is what I'm saying.
Your point stands, for sure. Uh-oh. This is the other part of this that I really love that I feel like you don't get from as many movies from this period, where you get, you know, tense scenes of combat here where it's like they're really interacting with the environment in a specific way. I don't know. It's just such an interesting way to stage like a suspense action scene where they're trying to really trick each other by manipulating the set. It's just interesting. And I feel like it's something that you miss from a lot of other, you know, Manhunt movies, you know? But again, the evolution of the genre has taken it in really different places. You were talking about earlier how it's taken on a much more strong, like, rich versus poor dichotomy,
yeah.
Even though that's present in this. In this, it's more specifically, like, decadent aristocracy versus new money.
Yeah, it's it's less like rich versus poor and more like that old unearned wealth and the
American dream.
The proper American wealth.
Yes, exactly.
The right way to hoard too much money.
Yes, you're exactly right, Max. But in future movies, it becomes more worked into, like, it becomes more closely associated with, like, a lot of dystopian stuff. Obviously, the most obvious example from the last 10 years is going to be The Hunger Games. But before that, you're going to get a lot of other examples where, you know, gladiatorial-type skirmishes between people who are poor for the amusement of the rich is going to be something that's, like, holding together societies or a key part of it. Whether it's like Death Race or The Running Man or Turkey Shoot or Surviving the Game.
Yeah.
With Ice-T.
My favorite film.
Have you seen Hard Target, the John Woo movie that's this premise?
No, I have not. I'd actually love to, though.
With Jean-Claude Van Damme.
Oh, you're making this sound more
and more
Wilford
Brimley.
I'm probably going to be terribly disappointed when I watch it. But
it's good. Okay. It's good, even though it's kind of butchered. I don't know if the cut that John Woo originally had still exists, but the studio kind of took it away from him. It also has a really good performance from Lance Henriksen as the evil guy. That movie's good. Hard Target is
great. John Woo and Jean-Claude Van Damme sounds like a grand old time.
Yeah. But it just goes to show that this is a concept that's been used over and over again. But it is interesting how it has taken this sharp turn into being like, yep, this is rich versus poor. That's what this is. In that movie specifically, Jean-Claude Van Damme, what is he? I think he's like a fucking homeless army vet. I might be wrong because I haven't seen it in a while, but he just gets picked up by these people.
Well, it's different. We mentioned earlier a spinoff of this genre, like Battle Royale, Which is a different type of thing.
Yes, for sure.
It's forcing everybody to hunt each other. But that's more... I mean, that's still, like, power dynamics. It's, like, forcing these kids to conform to a neo-fascist society in Japan.
Yeah, I suppose my point in bringing that up is that, like, the movies that took up this premise started to take it in other directions, and I think in so doing that, they kind of, like, shifted focus away from, like, the scene-by-scene, like, process of what the hunt would actually be like.
I think Battle Royale does that pretty well.
But... Well, they add different ingredients.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I feel like in Battle Royale, you don't get scenes of somebody, like, manipulating a bush to try to, like, lure someone. Like, this interesting thing about the second half of this movie is how much it protracts time. For as tightly edited as the first half of the movie is, the second half of the movie is kind of closer to real time, right?
Yeah.
There's some gaps, but they really draw it out. And it gives you an opportunity to see their thought process in action because it is closer to real time. And you're like, oh, we see Joel McRae put this spear in the fog, so when they run into it, they're going to get stabbed.
They're just going to ignore poor Igor on the ground there.
Yeah. Ivan the Cossack. I also love how they show, like, different like biomes of this island.
Oh, yeah. We get the dense forest. We get the swamp. It just makes it waterfall. It's great.
It's visually exciting.
We get the cliffside to show why they
don't just... get the cave that they're in.
To show why they don't just fucking go into the ocean.
Oh, and the alligator.
Yeah.
I love this alligator.
You were saying yesterday that more movies need to have actors on set next to a live alligator.
Because you're not in danger. If it's in the morning, you're not in danger. This alligator hasn't had sunlight to warm up its blood. It's not going to want anything to do with you.
Or just fucking put a rubber band on its mouth and...
You don't even have to do that.
No, but I'm saying, like, if you want to film for extended periods of time, put a rubber band on its mouth and fucking clean that up with computers later. Like, it's not that hard. Like, they're not super dangerous if you know what you're doing.
Yeah.
Hence why a man became famous for wrestling crocodiles on television.
Oh, man.
Oh, that's some King Kong-ass map painting right there.
This might even be the same, like, log bridge prop from King Kong. Once again, used very effectively here. I love that shot of the dogs running over it. They're so tenacious in this.
Yeah.
I will say, though, Max, we have one terrible moment in the script. It's one of the only moments where this feels like a Hays Code thing. If you'll remember that hilarious scene that's kind of like the intermission moment from... Scarface, where they're like, crime doesn't pay. Do you remember that? Where, like, the DEA is like,
oh, yeah.
He's like talking to the other Italians or whatever. And he's like, you know, Johnny Scarface is a shame to your entire race, you Italians. And it feels like he's looking right at the camera. We're going to get this moment here from Joel McRae where the dogs are barking at him on the tree. And he's like, now I know what it feels like to be the Jaguar. It's like, okay, you didn't have to do that movie. I think I got the point before that.
You kept me thinking of a fucking scene from, I think it was season one of Star Trek, The Next Generation, where it's like an episode about like a race that gets addicted to drugs. And at the end, they have a like PSA where it feels like Mr. T should have shown up, where it's just Wesley Crusher, the nerdy little kid being like, why would anybody voluntarily get addicted to a chemical? It seems like such a bad idea.
Looks at,
like,
the camera.
Yeah, Jesus fucking Christ.
I meant to ask you, actually, Max. Has Star Trek ever done a variation of this premise? It would be cool to see, like, you know, your favorite captain have to get out of, like, I'm being hunted by an alien race.
And then
still be nice about it.
There's some things like that. I mean, it's not the same thing. The first episode that came to mind instantly was an episode called The Most Toys, where Data, the android, gets kidnapped by, like, this rich collector and is forced to live in his, like, exorbitant compound as, like, a trophy, not a person.
Certainly thematically similar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those rear-view projections look great. They definitely shot the foreground material with a little bit of a scrim or something.
Oh, poor dog.
Yeah, that dog is just swimming. It's fine.
I know. I'm saying in the context of the movie, I still feel bad for that dog. That dog is perfectly fine.
I suppose.
I mean, that dog is dead now, but I'm saying at the time it was perfectly fine.
Also, I think it's just visually beautiful. Look at that shot, Max. The way it's like silhouetted against the river. It looks kind of like a Lott Reiniger movie. It's beautiful.
I thought it was a strange thing at first to end it on a waterfall, but it does, like, this is one of the best sets in the movie. It really works.
Yeah, because I think there's something just really dynamic about falling water, and it does kind of look vaguely expressionistic. Here's the moment you mentioned earlier, yes, where Joel McRae has to pretend to wrestle with a happy Great Dane. And luckily, the contrast is not good enough between the cave and the dog itself to see the dog wagging its tail in amusement.
Yes, and the dog is like biting his knife, which I'm assuming is...
They put peanut butter on the knife.
Yeah, the peanut butter is on the knife, so the dog is super happy.
And the next one is going to... It's funny because when the next one tries to bite him right away, it just goes for his knife.
Yeah.
I love shit like that. Oh, man, he just came.
Oh. Saw his face there.
He really goes crazy with the over-the-top expressions. But yeah, what just happened is that Rainsford fell off the waterfall. And Count Zaroff is very satisfied.
He had 1 minute before the time ran out that he set for himself. Would he have let them go?
No way. No way is he going to sacrifice the ability to like get off.
Yeah.
And again, that...
Or was it like... Was his deal like, okay, if you survive till morning, you get to keep living on this island? Like, what? I don't...
Oh, there was no way he was going to have any sort of honor about it at all. But again, I just want to point out those two close-ups. That shot, reverse shot of Faye Ray and Zaroff locking eyes before he takes her away. Once again, shots like that are very, like, fetishistic and weird for close-ups of this time period. And they're really revealing, like... a specific like character detail that you wouldn't get from a lot of them. Like the close-ups have a very strong purpose in this movie. And I think it works to really extrapolate on like the demented mindset of this serial killer. And it makes, I think it really adds to Faye Ray's performance as well, because when she responds and freaks out in that close-up, it's already communicating like, oh, he's fixated on her now as like the sexual object that he's going to dominate next. And she's horrified. And it's like, yep, that is terrible. That is terrible to think about.
You were talking about no honor. Because if I was in this situation and I was here, I wouldn't have closed the door and made a big thing. I would have just taken that lock and beaten him over the head with it immediately.
Is so stupid. The lock is literally a giant knife that you could stab him through the brain with. Why are you doing this, Joel McRae?
Because he has honor as a hunter, unlike this fucker.
This is not a hunt. And of course, here we have the other villain archetype that starts in this movie, a fancy robe. All villains have a fancy robe they wear. And that's the sign that you should attack them if you're the protagonist in a movie.
Name two other villains that wear a fancy robe.
Well, for one thing, have you seen... the movie Pink Flamingos. Someone's wearing a robe somewhere.
The guy who always flashes people does wear a robe quite a lot in that movie. So you're not wrong.
I would say that you're on the side of the villains.
No, I'm
that.
Not.
It's a celebration of villainy in that movie.
No, because the villains are the squares who are trying too hard to be filthy.
Yeah. Here we have the...
I don't support the people who have a rape basement where they sell the babies to lesbian couples and then donate the proceeds to a bunch of crack pushers in the inner city elementary schools.
That is how we afforded our podcast equipment.
Yes.
But we stopped after that.
We had a goal and we reached it.
Yeah, we got out. Oh, here we have the goofy combat.
Yeah. You were saying this does feel realistic and...
Well, they don't cut away from it.
Yeah. And I guess you're right, but there's a reason that realistic martial arts isn't fun to watch.
Just flopping around.
Yeah, their arms are flopping everywhere.
I guess the thing that's like sells it a little bit more to me is the fact that when they're throwing each other around, they actually do hit the ground with quite a bit of force. And it's like, oh my God, you really did just like fly through the air and land on your face, didn't you? And then I will say the ending of it is a little bit bizarre, even though it is another example of violence where like Joel McRae fucking suplexes this guy and breaks his back.
Fucking Zangief Atomic Buster over here. Jesus. You can, a Street Fighter move.
Max, if you turn up the audio, you can hear a back breaking sound. So he snapped that guy's spine in half. It's just very funny to think of Joel McRae doing
He's doing a WWE move.
Yeah. And now he's killed Zaroff.
I think Zaroff was getting off there too. And he's just like, oh, I could have just been fucking choking myself and masturbating this entire time. And I would have gotten off just as much. What if he had discovered autoerotic asphyxiation before he decided to go straight to killing people?
I don't think it would have saved him.
Saved him? No, but he might have killed himself before he started killing people. Is what I'm
saying. I suppose it would not have saved him from killing other people.
Other people, maybe, if he had killed himself first. Knife man, you need to give up. You're not doing anything with those.
Yeah, he's got a gun now. Sorry. I love how elegantly, like, straightforward the ending of this movie is as well.
No fluff. No, just like, is he truly worse than any other hunter? Or, like, we don't have any, like, forced on altruism moral at the end of it. It's just like, no, the story's over now. Cool.
Yeah. And I think that's a really big benefit of it, because even if something is very lean in terms of the plot elements, if it's not focused on being like shorter, I think there's a lot of space for like bullshit, dumbass dialogue to fall in. And this movie doesn't really have a lot of that. This guy falls to his dogs in the sense of this, like,
oh, they look so happy though.
They're finally going to eat him. Yeah. But of course, it's the grand irony of his villainy, right? Is that he's going to be consumed by some of the beasts that he would have hunted, right? But yeah, and then it's over. And you know what else I really appreciate about it, Max? They added in Faye Ray. No love interest thing.
Yeah.
No. It is a man and a woman, you know, on screen together running in peril. But I really appreciate that there's no love interest, and it makes Faye Ray's character a lot stronger. Even though I do think she does give the best performance
in this movie. I wish she had more opportunity to give a performance in the second half of the movie.
But. Yeah. But nonetheless, I think it's great that they had that restraint to do that, you know? So I don't know. There's a lot of stuff we didn't talk about, but I think we hit a lot of the big points. This movie touches a lot of different other genres and has a very broad influence. And it's only 60 minutes, so I think it's something that our listeners can really check out at any time if they want to. And again, it's public domain. You can find it online. And it's easy to recommend because of its length as well.
And if something that else is easy to recommend is the rest of our episodes.
I don't know about that.
I believe in us. And if you want to listen to any of our other episodes, you can check us out on YouTube, on Spectator Film Podcast, or on Spotify, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Radio Podcasts Into Space,
Letterboxd.
Yes, everywhere. We're everywhere. But yeah, Austin, any final words before I shoot you?
No, I was going to ask you, Max, actually, if there is a billionaire alive today, which one do you think is the one that has hunted people for sport?
Has Real or answer. Is most likely to?
Has. Or is most likely to?
Has Richard Branson from Virgin. I think he already has.
Really?
If I have to guess who is going to, Elon Musk will live stream it on Twitter.